been really an exciting adventure, I have to tell you. We've been meeting as pastors for about 5 years now, monthly. Just to get acquainted first, and I was welcomed into this circle of fellowship that was already existing when I arrived in 2005. And as we began to develop and deepen our relationship with one another as brothers and as co-laborers, God not only knit our hearts together in love, but He began to give us a vision for Grants Pass. That quite frankly is beyond the ability, in our opinion, of any single church truly accomplishing. I mean, I love Grants Pass. It's the climate, right? I mean, what a beautiful morning today is. But it's a friendly community. People will take the time to talk to you and get to know you if you'll simply give yourself that opportunity. And there are truly so many wonderful churches in this community. I'm happy to tell you that 20 churches are already involved and more are signing up to be a part of Serve Grants Pass. Now, why would we want to serve Grants Pass? Because it's the place that God has planted all of us. One of the things I love about Grants Pass is it's fairly well defined by the Rogue River. It's the largest community along this beautiful river that I have loved since I was just a teenager. I moved to this area from Las Vegas, Nevada in 1967. I was a senior in high school when my parents found out I was dealing drugs and went kind of down that hippie trail, you know. And so my stepfather had retired from working for the University of California and the Lawrence Livermore Radiation Laboratories. And he bought a little acreage up on Cane Creek Road outside of Central Point. So in the middle of my senior year, my mom was working for the school district down in Las Vegas. She and I were living in an apartment there while my stepfather was kind of settling this little dream house that they had. The Airstream trailer was more comfortable than the house, but nonetheless, you know, that pioneering spirit that brings us sometimes to these beautiful areas of the Northwest. So I enrolled at Crater High School. I'm happy to tell you that I did graduate. I was made a ward of the court by the Jackson County Juvenile Department. I was arrested in my freshman year at Southern Oregon College. It was before it was a university. But the grace of Jesus Christ, you know, God has chosen the foolish things of the world, the things that are nothing to bring to nothing, you know, the things that are. God has a great sense of humor. He took this hippie and turned him into a musician and a pastor. God can make anything that He wants to make. You know, it's an amazing thing, but He is able. I'm happy to introduce my topic, salt and light. Matthew 5, verses 13 through 16 will be our text. There are notes for you in the bulletin you might want to complete as we go through this study. And I want to share with you that passage as we begin. Jesus, of course, was talking to His disciples. But why was He talking to His disciples? We're told in Matthew chapter 4 that Jesus saw the multitudes. He saw the multitudes. And how did Jesus see the multitudes? He saw them as sheep without a shepherd. Boy, does that define the people in our community pretty well? People who are not believers are following this thing and that thing and the other and some new fad or some new thing that comes along that attracts their attention. I think Jesus still looks on the multitudes with compassion. So what does He do? He sets Himself on a mountain and calls His disciples to Him. That would lead us to the conclusion that Jesus knows that He's only going to be here on earth for a short period of time. I mean, 3 years goes by so fast. I don't know about you, but I used to look forward to birthdays. But time just seems to be accelerating. I'm going to be 60 in September. And many of you are looking, oh, you're just a kid. Bless your hearts. But Jesus truly wanted the disciples to realize that after his departure, they were going to reach the multitudes. Just like God looking down upon the multitudes in Josephine County, we are exclusively the ones who can either reach the multitudes for Jesus or not. So let's read our text, shall we? You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Let's pause right there for a moment and take a look at salt. Salt, sodium chloride. I mean, it's just a very simple and inexpensive item. Can be mined from the earth. A rock salt can be crushed and pulverized and made table salt. Or we can evaporate salt water and make salt that way. But how many of you ladies tap your husband on the shoulder and say, "Sweetheart, thank you so much for giving me those grocery ads this week. We're going to save bundles." Why is that, honey? Salt is on sale. And because salt is on sale, I got the coupon right here in the ad, and I'm going to march right down and buy a ton. You'd think, why, my goodness, we got salt in the house. We got salt shakers and bags of salt. Why would we? I mean, salt is just cheap and inexpensive, and quite frankly, we don't give it much of a thought. But let's ask this question. What was salt in the thinking of those who heard Jesus first say, "You and you alone are the salt of the earth"? What was the paradigm that Jesus was using when he told those young Jewish people, "You are the salt of the earth"? Well, thanks to the Old Testament, we can answer that question. Let's take a look at a few passages in the Old Testament that refer to salt. Again, what paradigm was Jesus using when he called his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth"? I mean, I know what salt means to me, and I suppose it means the same to you. You can season your steak or your eggs, fried egg sandwich, like my wife Vicky made for me last night. I love having breakfast for dinner. And a little salt and pepper, mustard and mayonnaise on some bread and a fried egg sandwich just makes me feel at home. After three or four of those, I mean, my goodness, you know, it's like my granddaughter says, "Yummy in the tummy, Grandpa." But what were the disciples thinking about when Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth"? First, we have to look at Leviticus 2, verse 13. "Every grain offering of yours, moreover, you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt." Now, isn't that interesting? If I'm one of the people that heard Jesus say these words when he originally spoke them, that could be what I might be believing Jesus is trying to tell me. Reminding me that, oh, yeah, salt is used in worship. Whether it's the tabernacle or the temple, every offering that's offered to God has to be seasoned with salt. Did you know that previously? Did you know that every offering in the Old Covenant had to be salted with salt? Now, secondly, let's take a look at a passage in Ezekiel 16, verse 4. I think you'll find this extraordinary. Now, Ezekiel is talking about the city of Jerusalem, and he's using a metaphor. He's describing Jerusalem as a newborn child. As for your birth, on the day you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water for cleansing. You were not rubbed with salt or even wrapped in cloths. Wow. Now, think with me. I have a feeling we've got lots of moms here. And ladies, I want to tell you before I say this, I have no clue. Although I've had three of my own children, I have a clue what it's like to give birth to a baby. Okay? So we'll make sure we're straight on that right off the get-go. But can you imagine there you are in the birthing center, and as that little child you've brought into the world is carefully washed with water, you watch as the attendants, the midwives, the nurses go over to the cabin and get the Mortons out and start sprinkling salt and rubbing it into the skin of your baby. You'd have a cow. You'd say, what are you doing to my baby? Bring her here. Bring him here. Well, you see, there wasn't any Johnson & Johnson's baby powder back in the time of the Old Testament. So salt was used as an antiseptic. When a newborn was brought into the world, believe me, in some pretty less than ideal environments. There were no hospitals or birthing centers. The body was washed with clean water, and then salt was rubbed into that tender, precious skin of the newborn, and then the whole body was wrapped in linen cloths. Now, does that remind you of a story that you know? Every year we celebrate what the angels said to the shepherds who were keeping watch of their flocks by night. This will be the sign unto you. You will find the babe lying in a manger and wrapped in swaddling cloths. Now we know what swaddling cloths were. I can tell you historically that by the time Jesus was born, salt was soaked into the linen cloths, and so the newborn baby was wrapped in linen cloths as an antiseptic protectant for that new little body. Now, it's interesting, the angels told the shepherds that that would be a sign, the sign unto them. Fast forward 32 years, and what do we see once again? Joseph of Arimathea begged Pontius Pilate and got the body of Jesus down from the cross. The ladies washed him and what? Wrapped him in clean linen. Not soaked with salt, but soaked with costly, fragrant oils and ointments before they placed his body, not in a manger, but in a cold tomb that had been carved out of solid rock. The sign is unmistakable. Now, let's look at another Old Testament passage, Judges 9:45. This is an interesting one. Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he captured the city and killed the people who were in it. Then he razed the city and sowed it with salt. Anybody have an idea? Why would Abimelech, after defeating the enemy and destroying the city, why would he start sprinkling salt all over the ground? What? The plants won't grow. Exactly. It'll make the soil unfertile. I love driving by Gary's yard. It's one of the most beautiful gardens on Clover Lawn. And every year I get to watch him go out there and rototill that beautiful, fertile soil and begin to plant his garden, which it just grows so wonderfully. But if you went over to his house with a bag of salt and started sprinkling it on that freshly tilled soil, Gary'd get pretty upset with you because, indeed, salt has the capacity to make soil unfertile. That's why Abimelech sowed salt all around the city and its soil. So the enemy, even if it returned to the city, couldn't stay there because in that agrarian culture, every population was dependent on the ability to grow their own crops. You know, if times really, really ever got tough in Southern Oregon, we are really blessed to live in an environment where clean water is readily available, and fish and wildlife are available, and we can grow our own food. One last Old Testament passage, 2 Kings chapter 2. He went out to the spring of water and threw salt in it and said, "Thus says the Lord, I have purified these waters. There shall not be from their death or unfruitfulness any longer." So the waters have been purified to this day according to the word of Elisha which he spoke. So salt, when sprinkled on this soil, caused it to be unfertile, preventing the enemy from returning. But in the case of Jericho, Elisha the prophet poured salt into the spring, the well of the city, and it healed the waters. So what can we conclude about salt? How can we really understand the paradigm that Jesus was using when he told his disciples, "You're the salt of the earth"? Salt was included in every offering. Salt was rubbed on a newborn skin as an antiseptic. Salt was sown on the land to prevent it from being inhabited by the enemy. Salt healed the waters at Jericho. First, everything we offer to God must include our awareness that we are salt. What does that mean, Denny? How do I apply that in my own life? You know, I loved singing with the worship team this morning, and especially those wonderful hymns that we sang. But you know, I know the words of those songs that are familiar to me in such a way that, quite frankly, I have to confess, I could sing the song and the melody and my mind could be a million miles away. I could be thinking to myself, I wonder how long the line at Elmer's is going to be when I get there for, you know, our Sunday brunch. You see, salt represents us, ourselves. You see, God doesn't just want what we can give him. He wants you. You are the apple of his eye. You know, it's an amazing thing, but sometimes we can mistake the gift for the giver of the gift. When I was a little boy, I was 5 years old when my parents were divorced. I'll never forget, after my mom remarried and my stepfather was transferred down to Las Vegas to the Mercury test site, my dad, who was a journalist all his life, he worked for newspapers, the Oakland Tribune, the San Jose Mercury News, and he came for a visit to see my two older brothers and I. And I'll never forget, he drove up to our little duplex on Sycamore Trail in Las Vegas, and I went flying out of the front door, and I went running into my dad's arms, and I just grabbed him, and I hugged him, and he said, "Hey, how are you doing, Cyclone?" That's what my dad called me. It was my nickname. Dennis the Menace was already taken, so he named me Cyclone. You know, like that little Tasmanian devil, the little whirling dervish on the cartoons? I was just a man of action. Wasn't always good action, wasn't always productive, but man, I was just on the go constantly, like a cyclone. He said, "Cyclone, take a look in the back seat." So I went over to my dad's Pontiac. It was actually his older brother Bud's Pontiac convertible. Yellow with a white top, and the top was down. The white Naga hide seats in the front and the back. And I reached over to see this huge package gift wrap just for me. And I grabbed that thing and I walked like Frankenstein back into the duplex. And I sat that box on the carpet and I ripped all the wrapping off of it and got into the box, and my dad had bought me a army tank. Not a real one, wouldn't have fit in a box, but it was a toy, a Tonka tank. had a moving turret and tracks that actually worked and had wheels and a friction motor and a little red transparent plastic barrel. And when I pushed that tank across the carpeted floor, the friction motor got going inside and a spark generator started shooting sparks out of the barrel. Lucky I didn't set the curtains on fire with that thing, but my mom was so glad that I was happy to receive that gift. It was the most amazing gift I'd ever received in my young life. But you know, the next time my dad came for a visit, something interesting happened. I came running out the front door of that little duplex on Sycamore Trail. My dad standing there in the walkway, I went running right past him. Ran to the back seat. What'd you bring me this time, Dad? Isn't that just like us? We come to services to worship together, and the Father is waiting to embrace us. And we go running right past Him. We're looking for something He can offer us. What'd you bring me this time, Dad? What gift have you brought to give to me? Now, listen, I'm just as convicted as you may be right now. But truly, salt had to be included in every offering to convey to us that God is not interested in what we give to Him. He's interested in us. He's interested in you. And He wants to have fellowship with you. Secondly, I think we can apply this. We must fight to preserve and protect the life of the newborn and the unborn. Christians are the salt that needs to be rubbed into the skin of the unborn and the newborn. We are the last line of defense against abortion in this country. 50 million people. 50 million children murdered since Roe v. Wade. I stood outside the Supreme Court building this week. We were in Washington, D.C. for the Family Research Council Watchman on the Wall pastors briefing. We must defend the right to life in this country. I'm so grateful for the Ministry of Pregnancy Care Center. I'm so glad that many of you support and pray for that important ministry. Robin Fuller and the people that are there are personal friends, and I'm thrilled to tell you that I'm so happy about their new facility. But truly, the church needs to be salt in that arena. Thirdly, wherever we are sown, we must work to prevent the enemy from establishing his habitation. Why do you suppose we all don't live in the same neighborhood? I wouldn't want to be your neighbor, Denny. That's why. No, I don't know. We're just here, there, and everywhere. I mean, if we were to look on a map, our homes are probably spread out in great places all over this county. You see, salt isn't very good if it's left in the shaker. You need to shake the salt out and distribute it. I bet you've got this down to an art. I'm getting so blind, it's hard to see that little white stuff coming out of the salt shaker, but man, I make sure that I distribute it all around the food that I'm seasoning. In the same regard, God has us in different neighborhoods, in different schools, in different occupations, in different jobs, different businesses, different churches, so that wherever we are sown, the enemy cannot establish a habitation. And then fourthly, we are to be salt because we're an influence at the source of a community's life for health and healing. When Elisha poured that cruse of salt into the waters, it was literally the future of that community, Jericho, that was at risk. It was at the source of the water that the salt had to be applied. Sadly, the church in this country has become reactionary. We ought to be the initiators. We ought to be the leaders. And so tragically, oftentimes, we are disengaged in the civic arena, disengaged in the public arena. Salt needs to be right at the source of a community's life for health and healing. But what risk, Denny, is there not being the salt of the earth? I don't know if I really like the idea of doing these things. Well, here's the risk. We have no value. We are thrown out. And we are trampled underfoot by men. My goodness. There's a great risk if we decide that we don't want to participate. We don't want to be the salt of the earth. But Matthew goes on to tell us, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Aren't you glad that when you go home at night, you don't have to take a baseball bat while you get out of the car in the garage? Now, honey, you stay right there. I'm going to walk into the door, and I'm going to drive the darkness right out of the house. You walk in with that serious look on your face, and you grab that baseball bat with all your might, and you're ready to drive the door. No. You just go over and flip a switch. You just turn the light. I don't know where the darkness goes. Doesn't go very far. Turn the switch off, it's right back. But it's an amazing thing. Light is a powerful, powerful, powerful thing. If a flashlight is needed in a dark cave, I've done some spelunking in the caverns and the caves here in southern Oregon. And boy, a flashlight is a great... It doesn't have to be much light. Even a little light in a cave is enough to help you. I love those little book lights, you know, so you can read a book while everybody else is sleeping. Comes in handy at retreats. You don't have the earplugs, you know, and the snoring contest is really raging. It's great to have that little itty-bitty book light so you can read. Isn't it amazing how important light is? Now, I don't know about you, but my wife is a great decorator. She's got her little nest just so. And in our bedroom, I know where every piece of furniture Vicky has placed. I know the exact location. It's been there for a long time. I have it memorized. I could picture it in my mind if you were asked me right now. But you know, without light in the middle of the night, I get up and I don't want to disturb her, so I don't turn the light on. And I start to walk across the room, and pretty soon I'm hopping around on one foot because I put my toe right into one of those pieces of furniture. I know where it was. You see, even in a place of familiarity, light is an important thing to have. Because even in the familiar, darkness can be dangerous. I don't like stumbling and bumbling, but my favorite source of light is the sun. Oh, on a sunrise or a sunset, boy, the light of the sun is such a beautiful thing to behold. Now, what paradigm was Jesus using when he told his disciples, you are the light of the world? In Genesis chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. Isn't it interesting? It's mentioned four times in just those two verses. Light, 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 light. I think God is trying to tell us something. Light is really important. In Exodus 13:21, the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light that they might travel by day and night. Light was essential to their navigation. In Exodus 27, we read about the light that was burning in the lamp in the tabernacle continually. In Isaiah 60, verse 1, Isaiah pens these wonderful words, arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Light. Four things we can learn from the Old Testament. Light was God's first word at creation. Light was God's manifest presence with the children of Israel. Light was the golden lampstand and the tabernacle and then the temple. Light was the promised Messiah. Light is first and foremost something that Jesus says belongs to him. In John chapter 8, verse 12, then Jesus again spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. So what does it mean, Denny, to be the light of the world today? Well, first and foremost, light is illumination. Light is illumination. It allows us to see clearly. It identifies the difference between light and darkness, good and evil. It exposes via that illumination. Even on a cloudy morning, you know that the sun has risen and is above the clouds, even though the surface can be dark. But as the earth continues to rotate, the sun begins to burn the clouds away. You can see the rays of the sun dissipating the barrier between us and the source of that light until the sky is blue and in the noonday the sun shines so very brightly. But light is not only illumination, it's manifestation. Light displays to others the difference God light has made in us. If you've ever been on a short-term mission, training someone or teaching someone, if you've ever built a wall in a mission or painted a house of someone who couldn't paint their house themselves or built a fence just to help your neighbor out, you realize that light has that ability to manifest the difference God has made in your life. Perhaps it's carrying a child from the ravages of war to safety. But light is not only illumination and manifestation, light is radiation. It's worshiping God in spirit and in truth. I saw that radiation on your faces and in the faces of the worship team as they sang to God's glory and praise. And then lastly, light is magnification. That's focusing God's power and light in a darkening world. I need to ask you a question, can I? How many of you would confess to me that when you were much younger, you went to dad's desk or mom's drawer and you got that large magnifying glass out of the drawer and you took it outside to do experiments with solar light, the light of the sun? Come on, show of hands. How many of you? Okay, good, good, good. One of the things you discovered as you were kind of playing with that little magnifying glass is that depending on the size and the curvature of the lens, there's a focal length to the magnifying glass. You see, all of the rays of the sun are parallel rays. But when bent by clear glass, they literally can be focused onto one spot, one place, and wow, the energy that's released when you focus the rays of the sun on a clear day can ignite paper or branches, a little kindling. You can burn your initials on a piece of pine that you borrowed from your dad's shop. Now, I have to ask you one more question because I want to just make sure I'm among friends. How many of you would admit by raising your hands that you tormented insects, ants, bugs with that magnifying glass? Yeah. James has some honest people here. I'm so thrilled. But just think with me for a minute. We're certainly not going to torture anyone. We're not going to melt ants. But did you know that NASA actually experimented with the idea of launching a satellite with a giant magnifying glass? Not to melt ants, but to melt cities. That's how powerful the rays of the sun's light truly are. But think with me. If we, as the lens of that magnifying glass, as a group of churches, came together just to let the love of God be focused at one place at one time. Oh, the energy. The energy for good, not destruction, that could be focused and released. So how are we to be the light of the world, and what can we do? Well, back to our text. In Matthew 5:13 through 16, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. How are we to be the light of the world? We're to do it publicly before men, not privately. And what are we to do? Your good works. Serve Grants Pass, in my opinion, is the perfect opportunity for us to put this into action. Imagine 1,000 people on one Saturday in June simply doing things that are good works publicly before men. My hope and my prayer is that when Grants Pass sees the churches coming together to serve this community, that hearts will be set aflame. That the energy that's focused in the lives of those people who see those good works will glorify our Father who is in heaven. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. Lord, thank you for the opportunity to really kind of investigate the paradigms that Jesus might have been using when he told his disciples, you and you alone are the light of the world. You're the salt of the earth. Lord, I pray that we will make application in our own lives, not just on June 19th, but that, Lord, from this day forward, as we just simply discover your will for our lives, that we might incorporate this understanding and bring application in our daily life. There's not one of my days, Lord, that goes without using salt. Not one day goes by that I don't use light. And whether it's the light of the sun or the light in our house, the light headlights of our automobiles, Lord, salt and light are just the very essence of life on a day-by-day basis. So, Lord, I pray that, Father, as we hear your word, that our response might be in faith. And, Lord, I pray that you would just continue to bless Jerome Prairie Bible Church. This church has such a rich and wonderful and long history. Lord, thank you for the people who worship you here. Thank you for James Downing. Lord, I'm grateful for his friendship. I'm grateful, Lord, for his love for you and his compassion for people. And Lord, it's so great just to be here today and be part of your forever family. Lord, I pray that as we move forward, that Lord, you'll just begin to erase the lines in the sand that we've drawn that have kept us apart. That Lord, you'll begin to erase the artificial borders and boundaries that have prevented us, Lord, from being the salt and light in the community in which you have planted, sown us. Lord, we pray for the lives of the unborn and the newborn, that, Lord, you'd help us to be their champions, that we would fight to protect and preserve their life. Lord, that you would use us as illumination and, Lord, radiation as we worship you, magnification as we focus your light upon, Lord, this community. So, Lord, help us to respond today in the best way we can in truly recommitting ourselves to being salt and light in Jesus' name. And all God's people said,